Imagine waking up at an age when society basically tells you it's time to start winding down.
Right, like you're supposed to be taking it easy.
Yeah, exactly. But instead, you realize your life's true calling has literally just begun.
Oh, wow, that is a heavy realization.
Totally. And the thing is, you don't have time to build this, carefully curated aesthetic. You don't have decades to play the whole gallery politics game.
Because the clock is ticking, you just have to start creating, right? Like your very survival depends on it.
Exactly. And that is the exact premise of today's deep dive. We are exploring the work of an artist named Jairo Duke.
It's a fascinating story. It completely shatters that pervasive narrative we have about human development. We usually treat personal growth like a ticking clock, you know, rather than this vast open landscape that you just keep exploring over a lifetime.
Right. And what we have in front of us today is a deeply personal, a really emotionally charged artistic manifesto. We're looking at two distinct but totally intertwined documents.
Which give us a complete picture of his process.
Yeah, first we have a section called the intro, where he lays out this pretty radical philosophy, like a heavy rebellion against the modern art world. And second, a document called En mi traster, which translates roughly to in my moving or in my shifting. And that details the actual execution of his work on the canvas.
Our mission today is to trace this chronological progression. It's essentially the story of a man finding a profound artistic voice late in life, and that leads him to develop this fascinating concept he calls Trasteo.
Okay, let's unpack this concept right away because Trasteo is the engine driving everything we're about to discuss today.
It really is the core of it all.
So in conversational Spanish, the word usually refers to just moving house, the physical act of shuffling things around, packing up your furniture, and relocating.
Right, just a standard move.
But Duke elevates it. For him, it's not just about boxes in a moving van. He's talking about a constant, lifelong shifting of existence. It's about memory and spiritual searching.
So it's the act of continuously packing and unpacking your own soul, in a way.
I love that framing, yes.
He describes this condition not as a linear A to B journey, but as a permanent state of displacement. Like we are always moving from one state of being to another.
Which is very relatable, honestly.
It is. And using that non-linear, unpredictable approach is really the only lens through which we can understand his actual entry into the art world.
So we have to start chronologically in 2016, because Duke didn't begin as some 20-something art school prodigy.
Far from it.
Yeah, in the text, he describes painting as a postponed idea.
Yeah.
It was something just sort of lingering in the background of his life. But then in 2016, something shifts.
A major tristeo, you could say.
Exactly. It stops being this hobby he hopes to eventually get around to, and it becomes what he calls a vital necessity. Like it literally transforms into the resource he requires to just sustain his existence.
What's fascinating here is how the phrase vital necessity carries immense weight. It completely reframes the act of creation for him.
Also,
Well, art isn't a luxury for him. It's not a career choice or a pursuit of fame. It is a literal survival mechanism. It becomes his primary language for processing the world.
wow, yeah.
And because he arrives at this realization later in life, driven by pure necessity, it fundamentally alters how he interacts with the established rules of the contemporary art market.
Oh, he doesn't just alter how he interacts with them. He basically takes a sledgehammer to those rules.
He really does.
This is actually one of the most compelling internal conflicts in the text. In the contemporary art market, there is this suffocating pressure to develop a recognizable brand.
Right, like an artist is supposed to have a unique, highly specific style.
Yeah. So you can look at a canvas from like 50 feet away and instantly recognize the creator.
Yeah.
But Duke views that expectation as a total prison.
He views that kind of homogenization, forcing yourself into a single, easily digestible, marketable box as fundamentally dishonest to the human experience.
Completely dishonest.
If your goal is to document the raw reality of life, you just can't filter everything through the exact same visual preset.
So he insists on painting without masks. He'll use watercolor for one piece, thick acrylic for the next, and then switch to digital art.
Whatever the emotion demands.
Wherever it demands. It reminds me of starting a marathon at mile 20.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Think about it. If you jump into a race with only 6 miles left, you don't have the luxury of worrying about whether your running outfit matches. Or if you look effortlessly cool for the spectators, you just need to run.
Right, the urgency just strips away all the pretense.
Exactly. You just have to get the ideas out.
That captures his urgency perfectly. He argues extensively in the introduction that his diversity of mediums and styles isn't dispersion, and it certainly isn't a lack of focus.
It's intentional.
Very much so. It is the direct reflection of a mind that refuses to reduce the vast, complex, messy nature of human existence into a single aesthetic language.
Which makes total sense when you say it like that.
The mechanism makes sense, yeah. Why should the chaotic, heavy feeling of profound grief be painted using the exact same delicate watercolor technique as a moment of absolute weightless joy?
They absolutely shouldn't. But this does raise a sort of mechanical question for me.
Okay, what is it?
If he completely abandons a single visual style, how does he organize his artistic universe? I mean, it could easily devolve into total chaos, right?
It could, but it doesn't. The text explains that he anchors his work using a three-part system, a triangulation of art.
Right, the triangle. Let's break that down.
So the first point of the triangle is the body. This represents the tangible, technical dimension of the work. It's the physical supports, the procedures, and the raw materials.
Okay, physical stuff.
Yeah. He frequently mentions relying on primary colors, blue, yellow, and red, and then mixing or tensioning them based entirely on what the specific project demands.
So it's the physical reality of the paint on the canvas or, you know, the stylus on the digital tablet.
Yes, exactly. Now, the second element is the emotion. This is the intangible reaction he is trying to provoke in the observer.
The feeling behind it.
Right. It's the invisible force that dictates why he selects one specific reference image over 100 others. The emotion is the filter.
And the third point, which basically acts as the foundation for the whole triangle, is the conceptual spirit.
Yes.
This is the core idea sustaining the work. And for Duke, that conceptual spirit is almost always Trastio itself.
That constant shifting.
Exactly. It's the invisible thread of movement and shifting memory that runs through every single piece, regardless of the physical medium he's using.
But, you know, diving into his process like this brings us to a massive, really fascinating paradox in the text.
Oh, it really is a glaring contradiction. On one hand, Duke is deeply committed to this raw, unposed, everyday honesty.
He wants it to be real.
Yeah, he states he wants to capture the ordinary without any solemnity or artificial spectacle. Even compares his observational gaze to that of a street photographer. Just raw reality transferred directly to the canvas.
And yet he relies heavily on highly mediated algorithmic technology.
So much technology.
He sources reference images from the web, always taking care to respect the original photographer's authorship, which is an important detail, but he also uses TikTok.
Which is wild for someone who rejects modern art trends.
Right. He shares the execution phases of his paintings on his account at DukeArt. And perhaps most surprisingly, he openly admits to using artificial intelligence to help write this very manifesto.
I have to admit, I really struggled with this part of the text when I first read it.
Really? Why is that?
Well, because if your entire ethos is about living this maskless existence and tearing down the artificial brands of the art world, isn't relying on a generative AI to write your deeply personal philosophy the ultimate mask?
It does sound counterintuitive at first.
It feels like the exact opposite of authenticity. You know?
It's a very natural pushback, and Duke actually anticipates this critique within the text itself. He explains the mechanism of how he uses AI, and it completely shifts the perspective.
Okay, how so?
He doesn't use AI to delegate his authentic voice. He uses it to compensate for his own expressive limitations in text. We have to remember, he is a visual artist first. Words are not his native language.
Ah, I see. So rather than letting the machine do the thinking, he's treating the AI like a paintbrush.
Precisely. The AI is just another tool located within the body of his work. It's sitting right next to his acrylics and his digital drawing pad.
That makes a lot of sense.
He provides the raw context, the deep motivations, the human core of the ideas, and then uses the algorithmic tool to review, adjust, and rewrite until the text mirrors what he sees in his head.
Wow.
As he writes, quote, "The text, like a painting, is a process."
That completely reframes the technology from a crutch into an amplifier. And honestly, it's a brilliant question to ask yourself as you're listening to this deep dive.
It really is.
Think about it. How are you interacting with modern tools? Are you letting the algorithm dictate your voice and smooth out all your rough edges? Or are you actively using these tools to amplify the raw, messy, very human ideas you already possess?
It takes incredible self-awareness to walk that line.
He walks it really well. And this theoretical foundation, this entire philosophy laid out in the intro, is the necessary preamble Now we can actually look at the physical work.
Yes, moving from theory to practice.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because a philosophy is just words until it's applied.
Yeah.
That brings us to the second document, initraster.
The shifting in action.
Exactly. How does this concept of packing and unpacking the soul actually translate into a painting?
Well, he organizes his actual body of work into thematic chapters, which he beautifully refers to as constellations.
Constellations, I love that.
The first constellation focuses on landscapes. He paints the Cienaga Grande de Santa Marta, which is this massive ecologically vital swamp in Colombia, alongside various scenes of the ocean, surfing, and coastal life.
But knowing what we know about his philosophy, these aren't just like decorative landscapes to hang in a hotel lobby, right?
Far from it. The environment acts as an active participant in his memory. He specifically focuses on water, the fluidity of the ocean, and the swamps.
Because of the movement.
Right. The mechanism here is that water serves as a physical metaphor for the constant shifting of Trestio. It represents the fluidity of consciousness, the washing away of the old, and a deeply spiritual link to the origins of life itself.
That reverence for life naturally flows into his next constellation, which focuses on animals.
Yes, the animal chapter is wonderful.
He dedicates works to domestic pets, but also to species that are fundamentally essential for the planet's equilibrium, like hummingbirds and bees.
The underlying logic here isn't just aesthetic appreciation, though. It's an ethical stance.
An ethical stance. How do you mean?
He paints these animals to argue that they share a common essence with human beings. By dedicating the same artistic rigor to a bee that one might dedicate to a human portrait, he is establishing a visual ethic of interspecies respect.
Oh, wow.
He is recognizing a shared consciousness across all living things.
It's a beautifully serene perspective. But he doesn't stay in the realm of literal representation. There is a whole chapter dedicated to surrealism and abstraction where he really stretches the boundaries of how Trestio can be visualized.
This is where we see the physical technique mirroring the conceptual idea perfectly. In his abstract work, he often uses a technique of pouring acrylics directly onto the canvas.
Just pouring it straight on?
Yeah. Instead of carefully controlling every single brush stroke, he lets the thick material flow, blend, and react unpredictably.
That sounds messy.
It is, but he uses this specific, free-flowing physical process to represent the messy, unpredictable nature of territorial nostalgia and cultural identity. The physical freedom of the paint mirrors the conceptual freedom of the Trestio.
And within this abstract exploration, we find the Homes and Faces series, which honestly serves as a massive pivot point in the document.
It really is a shift in tone.
Because a conscious life isn't just about serene oceans and hummingbirds. To truly pack and unpack the human soul, you have to confront the darkness too.
That is the core of the emotional journey in his work. You cannot claim to observe reality without masks if you only paint what is beautiful.
Right.
You must also confront what is profoundly painful and structurally broken in the world.
This realization pulls us directly into his Protesta chapter. And the tonal shift in the book here is radical. Painting suddenly stops being an instrument of serene contemplation and becomes a direct weapon of memory, denunciation, and resistance.
He really acts as a visual documentarian of global struggle here. In these pieces, the canvas becomes a historical record.
And just to look objectively at what he documents here, because he covers a lot of ground, he paints the 2021 social explosion in Colombia.
Yes.
The pieces focus intensely on the youth, indigenous communities, and working class sectors who are in direct opposition to the prevailing economic policies. He captures the friction of a society demanding change from a system that prioritized free market models over social welfare.
It's very intense. And he expands this lens to the global migration crisis as well. The art captures the harrowing, treacherous realities of human displacement.
It's a heartbreaking stuff.
It is. He has works depicting the journey through the Darien Gap, which is one of the most dangerous jungle crossings on the planet, as well as La Bestia, the notorious network of freight trains used by migrants traversing Central America.
The way the sources describe these pieces, it's not just passive observation. He uses the canvas to freeze the frantic, terrifying motion of a perilous journey. The art becomes a physical testament to a human struggle that society often tries to render invisible.
Truly giving a voice to the voiceless.
Exactly. The sources also mention pieces that defend the Palestinian population, specifically addressing the devastation in Gaza. Through all these works, art affirms itself as a practice of conscience, demanding solidarity. We're just looking at the realities he felt compelled to capture on canvas.
It is a heavy, emotionally taxing constellation of work, for sure. But what is crucial to understand about Duke's philosophy of Trestio is that the journey doesn't end in despair.
That's an important point.
He balances this intense political and social activism by immediately grounding the viewer in a profound search for spiritual truth.
The structure of the book makes this balance so clear. You turn the page from global protests, and suddenly you are enveloped in a chapter dedicated to historic sites and deep spiritual philosophy.
It's quite the juxtaposition.
He dives into Vedic philosophy, which are ancient Indian texts focused on transcending the material world, and Krishna consciousness, representing a path of devotion to a higher reality.
He paints representations of spiritual figures like Srila Prabhupada to anchor his work in these ancient ideas of devotion. But what's brilliant is how he integrates this East meets West spirituality.
I found that fascinating too.
He places these Eastern devotional iconographies right alongside Western historical architectures. He paints the Basilica of San Luis Gonzaga in Sevilla, the La Merced Complex in Cali, and the San Juan Capistrano Mission in California.
It's as if he's telling the viewer, yes, the physical world is burning with conflict, but there is an underlying ancient spiritual architecture we can tap into for refuge.
A sanctuary amidst the shifting.
Exactly. But amidst all this ancient philosophy and real-time political protest, there is one piece from 2019 that completely stopped me in my tracks. It's called Contra Cultura.
Oh, the anticipatory piece. It is remarkable when you consider the timeline.
Right. In 2019, years before the massive mainstream explosion of these technologies, Duke created a piece that condensed reflections on the transition to a computerized world.
He was way ahead of the curve.
He visually explored the emergence of AI, robotics, cryptocurrencies, and entirely new economic paradigms.
It proves that his concept of Trestio isn't purely nostalgic. He isn't just looking backward at history or memory.
He's looking forward.
Yes, he is actively processing the shifting tectonic plates of our current culture. He is a live, highly sensitive register of epochal changes happening right now.
Okay, so we've traveled a massive distance. We started with his rebellion against the art market. We've traversed the dangerous global migration routes. We've analyzed the transition into AI and crypto. And we've explored deep spiritual consciousness.
It's a vast journey.
So what does this all mean? After a lifetime of Trestio, of moving through all these heavy, collective, global themes, where does the journey actually end? What is the final destination of this manifesto?
The destination is deeply intimate, which might be the most surprising part of the entire project.
It really surprised me.
After casting his gaze across the entire world, he drastically narrows his focus. The penultimate chapter is called Momentos, Efficios, Moments, and Trades.
This is where he elevates the routine of daily labor.
Yes. He assigns historical and emotional value to the seemingly mundane. He paints Californian firefighters battling blazes, the ancient quiet art of falconry, the daily repetitive grind of fishermen, and simple family walks.
Just everyday moments.
Exactly. He creates a visual log where minor everyday incidents become vital testaments of an era. It's a deliberate downshifting of scale.
It acts as the necessary calm after the storm of the protest chapters. But that quiet elevation of daily life is just setting the stage for the ultimate emotional climax of the book.
The final chapter.
The final chapter, simply titled Retratos, Portraits.
When we connect this final chapter back to his foundational philosophy, it is incredibly poignant. A life spent in constant motion in a permanent state of Trestio requires anchors.
You need something to hold on to.
Exactly. If you are always packing and unpacking your soul, you need to know what you are holding on to. And for Duke, those anchors are the people he loves.
He paints his parents who have passed away. He paints his late sister. He paints his wife, his family, his friends, and his spiritual guides.
The act of painting his deceased loved ones is particularly powerful. It functions as an act of intimate biographical closure, but also as a kind of resurrection on the canvas.
Wow, resurrection on the canvas.
It's a profound homage to lineage, to love, and to memory itself. By dedicating the end of his book to the faces of the people who shaped his worldview, he effectively closes the circle of his journey.
It's incredible. He started this project late in life as a vital necessity to survive. He explored the absolute vastness of the human experience, the grief, the joy, the politics, the spirituality, and ended up right back at the hearth, looking at the people who matter most.
Which brings us back to the core question. What is the purpose of this text? When you view the intro and Enmi Trestir as a single cohesive unit, it becomes undeniable that this is not a promotional portfolio.
Definitely not.
It was not designed to catch the eye of a gallery owner looking for a trendy, cohesive brand.
Not at all. It is a raw testament to living a deeply conscious life. It's about having the courage to refuse the boxes society tries to put you in.
Absolutely.
It's about refusing to look away from the world's pain while also refusing to forget the simple beauty of a family pet or a loved one's face.
It is the embodiment of having the courage to start running the marathon at mile 20 and just refusing to stop.
I love that. Well, we want to thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the work of Jairo Duque. Exploring his art is a powerful reminder that existence really is a constant displacement of affections, of memories, and of spiritual searches.
We are all in our own ways constantly packing and unpacking.
We really are.
And that leaves us with a final thought for you to carry with you today. If Duque views his art as a trastier, a constant shuffling of his soul's furniture across different canvases to make sense of the world, what is the medium through which you document the trastio of your own life?
Oh, that is a fantastic question.
Think about it. If you were to look back at the thousands of photos sitting on your phone right now, or the random notes you've jotted down over the years, or the different places you've lived, what is the conceptual spirit that unites those seemingly disconnected phases of your existence?
What's the common thread?
Exactly. What is the invisible thread of your own trastio?
Something to think about the next time you scroll through your camera roll or look around your living room. Thanks for learning with us today. Keep exploring, keep shifting, and remember, the learning never stops.